Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Danny Harris Kornfeld, and I play Mark Cohen in the 20th anniversary tour of Rent.
As well as
I'm Caleb Wells, and I play Roger in the 20th anniversary tour of Rent.
And that 20th anniversary tour of Rent is making its last stop, actually, on the national tour. It's making its last stop here at the National Theater now through Sunday. So only a couple days left to see the end of the big 20th anniversary tour of this. So get your tickets now, everybody. I mean, Rent's, God, it's one of the greatest shows ever. It's one of my favorites. Have you guys ever seen it on stage before? Did you guys ever see the Broadway one?
Yeah, so okay. I saw it when I was 10, I believe, in New York on Broadway. Joey Fatone played Mark. And yeah, I was introduced to the CD beforehand, and then my parents, that was the first Broadway show I ever saw, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
So did that spark your desire to go
Absolutely.
Into acting?
Or? Yeah, and I think especially the role Mark was always on my radar ever since then of something that I've always wanted to play.
You went out and bought a scarf and a camera,
and
shirt.
Glasses. And,
That's awesome. How about you, Mr. Roger?
I never actually got a chance to see it on Broadway, but I did see it on stage in Boston when the tour came through for the first time, and listened to the album, you know, over and over and over again.
Like we all have.
all the time it was on. I mean, it's like 3 hours of music, so it filled many car rides. It filled many quiet times at home.
You plug it in and it plays for 525,600
actually.
Minutes.
And that song was just kind of on loop.
So it was more minutes than that. It
yeah,
was actually,
so many minutes.
Before we geek out too much, let's pretend that there's a listener that isn't aware of this. It seems impossible. They've been living under a rock musical. But explain the general premise of the show.
Yeah, so it's the story about a group of friends living in the East Village, late 80s, early 90s, at the height of the AIDS epidemic in New York City. And we follow them over the course of the year. And it's about their relationships with each other, falling in and out of love and loss and celebrating life.
Yeah, that's
a
good summary.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. And I think it's just that. I mean, AIDS, it has, you know, come a long way in terms of treatment and dealing with it, and people are living a lot longer. People are always asking, like, how is it still relevant? Is it still, you know, does it still pack a powerful punch? And I think that the show is not necessarily about the AIDS epidemic. It
right.
just happens to take place in that time
right.
where that was the struggle. But I think that, you know, people are still struggling with loss and with death and with trying to find themselves and, you know, being caught up in their own mortality and whatever it is in an individual's life, there's something in the show that they can relate to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And explain sort of how, I mean, your character, you know, go into your characters, but for your character especially.
Yeah. So Roger is HIV positive, he has AIDS, and he is dealing with not knowing when he is going to die. It could be any minute. It could be today, it could be tomorrow, it could be you know, a year from now. And he, unlike some of the other characters, kind of internalizes it in a very dark, negative way. And he's kind of given up at the top of the show. And he's really searching to kind of find his own voice and find something to leave behind because he knows he's going to die. And there are many other characters in the show who are dealing with the same thing he is. But
explain how it affects his potential relationship.
Well, that's the thing is he has kind of written himself off romantically because anyone that he, you know, kind of gives his heart to, he could end up killing them because, you know, that's the reality that we're dealing with in this time period. And, you know, AIDS is a death sentence at this time, and nobody really knows how it works or how it's cured. We know that AZT, the drug cocktail, can prolong your life somewhat, but inevitably, you know, people are going to succumb to the disease, and it could be a really dangerous thing to kind of open yourself up romantically or sexually,
and emotionally.
Yeah.
But it's still one of the most fascinating, you know, relationships on stage or screen, just that dynamic of, you know, your character has AIDS, so does it, we come to find out that she does too, right, in the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you both can't, you know, you don't want to say that. So it's just the dynamic there is just so awesome.
Exactly. And the kind of juxtaposition of the way they deal with it. You know, she goes and says, well, if I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to live my life fully. And he says, if I don't have a lot of time, I might as well just die now.
Right.
And like, you killed the me that's inside.
Right. She lights your candle and gets it back going again. Yeah. All right, you, sir, your character. We went a lot into Roger, but explain Mark a little bit. His role
Mark is the narrator of the story, and he's an aspiring filmmaker. So what we see on stage is his film over the course of the year, and he's not quite sure of what he's filming per se, but he goes out and he's observing all the interactions of his friends over the course of the year, and he's single. All his friends are in relationships, and it's watching them go through the trials and tribulations that come with love, which I find really interesting. And he is not HIV positive, so I think there's a lot of that struggle of watching your friends live their life and not knowing how much longer that you have with them. Yeah. And you want to celebrate every day, but also it's hard emotionally to not cut yourself off a little bit too if you're going to be the only one who's left.
Maybe is the camera lens sort of a way to keep that sort of distance?
Yeah,
you think,
and there's the whole thing in Act Two that people will see, and Roger gets in on him about it. But I think
But you're Mark also preserving them frozen in time, their lives. So
right.
It's
an
ways.
Emotional distance, but it's also, like you said, it's capturing it and maintaining it, and that'll continue to live on forever past however long his friends do.
Right. Well, it's important, too, as we talk, to explain sort of the backdrop and the setting, which also factors into the title of Rent. Explain sort of that, how they're sort of, would you say squatting? Would you say...
So... Roger and Mark have a friend, Benny, an old friend who has gone on to get himself involved with a pretty wealthy family. And so he has these ideas for creating this cyber art studio. Think new information technology, state of the art. Equipment and everything.
And which just late like, 90s would have been know, the cutting forward thinking,
And so he wants to evict them from their current apartment to build up this new idea that he has. And he says that they can stay there for free as long as they cancel their other friend Maureen's protest against him evicting this building and the lot next door. And so he represents the new age, new giving in just to like mainstream media and mainstream art. And the two of them are all about holding on to the integrity of just something that's fulfilling artistically.
Which I think is so interesting to kind of do the show 20 years later in a world where Benny and the Bennies of the world kind of won. You know, like the idea of selling out in the 90s and the 80s was such like an incomprehensible thing. Like, oh, you're such a sellout. And like the bands that you loved would like do a commercial and all of a sudden they're sellouts. Right. But like nowadays it's all about selling out, and it's like about selling your product and like finding like a way to work your art in and like get as many followers as you can and like get as many, you know, like sponsorships that you can, and the, you know, the Bennies of the world have kind of dominated and conquered. I mean, we have like a mentally ill narcissist in office right now, and he is a Benny. Like when the show was written, Benny and some of the characters in the show were very much based on that kind of capitalism, character that existed in the Manhattan real estate.
It was the changing time. It was, I mean, New York's come such a long way since then, but like it was the cusp of change, and I think Benny represents that.
And while I everything you say in terms of, you know, capitalistically has come to fruition, and almost this was kind of a warning of that, I will also at the same time, on the other side of it, in terms of, I mean, you say that Benny won out in that regard. But in terms of this Jonathan Larson slice of LGBT themes, Supreme Court ruling. Jonathan won on that, yeah, in a way. But explain sort of how...
Yeah.
Jonathan planting a seed. I guess cool. The first was off-Broadway in 93, right? I think it was the same year Philadelphia came out in Hollywood. So these both on both coasts were kind of planting the seed. But talk about how that grew over time and did change the world.
So, I mean, I know for myself, it was my first introduction to homosexual couples and also interracial couples. I had never seen that before represented. Angel and Collins, yeah. Joanne and Maureen. And so it sparked, and I was young too, but it sparked a lot of questions, and my parents were good about like not backing away from it. And I was like, Mom, like how do Angel and Collins know that they like each other? I mean, it's two guys. And she was like, they do. And I couldn't understand that then, but like, now, of course, I do.
Right.
And same, it was like my first introduction to knowing what AIDS was. And so the fact that these kind of stories weren't being told in a theater setting, especially in a musical theater setting. We had plays like Angels in America and The Normal Heart, which dealt with AIDS. But in a way, even though it's kind of like what Caleb said earlier, like even though the play is about AIDS, it's not just about that. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, the fact that like people go to the theater every night and get to see a character like Angel, who is a guy who just loves dressing up in women's clothing and expressing himself and dancing and feeling good, to see a character like that on stage who is respected, and it just gives people hope to know that there's people out there who are like me, and whether that it sparks something for them now or for 10 years from now, I think that's really important and special.
And I think it ages so well, and I think it's one of those rare things, remnants from the 90s, that does age so well.
Right.
Because you watch some like old movies from the 1980s and the 1990s, and in this politically correct terminology culture, like there are some things that you go, whoa, you could say that back then and get away with it, and like you could never say that now. And they never make jokes in relation to like making fun of Angel, you know, dressing as a woman, or like a lesbian couple or a gay couple. And it's so interesting to see the audiences come to see our show now, and all of the things that were so groundbreaking in the 90s are so normalized today. Nobody's like, wow, a gay couple like on the screen.
You're not joking. Not that there's anything wrong with that now, like you were back then.
Exactly.
And what's kind of cool is the show doesn't really have any labels per se.
Right.
Other people refer to other people as things, but no one ever says, I'm gay, I'm lesbian, I'm trans,
I'm
a drag queen. It's all, and that's why I think it remains even more timeless, is because we don't use dated terms in the piece like Caleb said.
That's a really great point. I'm glad you guys brought that up. It's because I think it was ahead of its time, which is why now it still works, whereas other things, I guess, were of the time and it seems kind of dated. But explain, I guess, more of in a broad sense too, not just the show, but how art in general can sort of get in there even before it's like the zeitgeist, but get in there on the front of it and plant sort of that seed of social change that then blossoms later. And now, you know, I feel like it's so easy for everyone in hindsight to look back and say, wow, that was the one. But just talk about how art itself can do that and why a lot of times it takes society a while to catch up.
I've heard it said that artists have the responsibility to show the dark underbelly to the times in which we live in. And I think Jonathan Larson did that in the sense of bringing people and lifestyles and disease that wasn't being talked about into an approachable yet alarming and disarming context that people could sit and feel something, but also genuinely enjoy and celebrate. And I think why Rent is so successful, and art that speaks in a similar fashion, is that you're not just focusing on the problems and the issues, but you're also celebrating the outcomes that are there with it. And that's the story of Rent. It's not celebrating. It's about celebrating how you live as opposed to how long you live.
Right.
And I think that's just it in terms of art. Real art, true art, is saying or doing the things that no one else is doing. And so then eventually, you know, it's so easy to look back on pieces or, you know, like going to the museum and seeing things from the 1960s or 70s and being like, well, I could do that. And it's like, yeah, but you didn't do that. And he did or she did. And nobody else was doing it.
Yeah.
And so then that kind of became the norm, and like people were seeing it more and more. And then as soon as one person does it, then everyone does it. And then it becomes kind of the way we live our lives. And then in hindsight, you can say like, oh, that must have been so easy. You know, because like, you know, like we were talking about, we see so many of the things in Rent have become so normalized. And so now it'd be like, oh, yeah, like that was life, but it wasn't. And nobody was talking about it. Nobody was talking about AIDS, you know, it politically, in the media. And so for one person to kind of say, hey, this is happening,
right,
and my friends are dying, and my friends are dealing with injustice racially and based on their sexual orientation, and nobody's talking about it. And the fact that he did talk about it in such a kind of groundbreaking but also approachable medium, mm-hmm, I think is very important.
So you think that the Hedwigs, the Kinky Boots, all of that would not exist without this?
I think they would, but it would have taken a lot.
Right.
It would have been someone else, and it would have taken a lot longer, I believe. Right.
And it broke the convention of storytelling, too, mm-hmm, is, I think before Rent, something similar would be like Hair,
right,
musical
right,
Hair.
Right.
But Rent broke how people were used to seeing stories told on stage, just in terms of the music and the content and the actual way the story unfolds. One of the things I think is amazing is we have parents' voicemails in the show.
And they were like, speak,
right,
answering machines.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, how are we going to get a phone on stage?
Right.
We're going to throw it, and they're going to catch it, and we're going to have two people stand at microphones and deliver a voicemail straight out to the audience. Like, that on paper doesn't necessarily make sense, right, but it takes a team of like minds, mm-hmm, to make that make sense and come about. Yeah. And I think that's why the show's
the other thing, too, is it broke how people consumed musical theater. And like you were saying, like another show that would be Rent or would have been Rent, it would have been something closer to Hair. It would have been more contemporary musical theater. And Rent kind of said, hey, there are so many people who need to hear this message who don't go to musical theater and don't listen to musicals and don't follow, you know, the musical theater genre. And so you have a lot of people now listening to this as an album of music that they enjoy. And so then that message gets across. And it's like Hamilton today. I mean, you have right, hip-hop artists covering a musical.
Yeah.
And people who have never seen a show before in their lives and have never been to the theater and would never do a musical, no Hamilton, back to front, because yeah, it connects with them in a way that no other musical has before.
It's one of those rare shows where the soundtrack was consumed widely.
Right.
I mean, we were just talking with the cast of Jesus Christ Superstar, how it began as a concept right, album before. But similarly, or Hamilton, or definitely Rent, for the sort of modern era, people consume that album and that OBC before they ever even saw the show. And some
yeah,
people probably never even got up to see the show. Yeah. They saw the movie or whatever, the Chris Columbus movie. But yeah, we got to go into the music. We've gotten this far and we haven't even gone into the song. You know, you have One Song Glory. Is that your favorite one to do?
I'd say One Song Glory is one of the more fun ones to do, but it is so empty and lonely. In terms of the staging, I mean, I'm the only one on stage aside from the band, but also the orchestration is so empty. You have that kind of delay, the dun 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 dun, dun, and there's no real support system from it, which, you know, leads to the storytelling of the song. But I think that's just it, is every song is tailored to the story. And so mm-hmm, that song is very empty and alone because that's what he's feeling. And Another Day is kind of two musical ideas fighting against each other. Roger has his musical line. Mimi has her musical line. They work together, but they don't really work together. They never really like right, kind of mesh. It's like I sing my thing and then you sing your thing, which works in the chords, but it's a completely different line. And something, you know, like I'll Cover You there, where Tom Collins and Angel kind of find their relationship is so in sync. Mm. And I think to see how the orchestration and the instrumentation and the vocals add to the storytelling makes almost every song interesting and unique.
Yeah.
How about for you, sir? Do you have a
It's
one that
changed.
You like?
It's interesting. I mean, being on the road for 10 months, my like favorite has changed over time. And as I continue to figure new things out and discover new things, Tango Marine is so fun just from like a silly aspect. But then I think right now I love What You Own at the very end of the show. It's like the moment of catharsis for Mark. And I think that's it for me.
For me, my song is when you guys do Will I. I always choke up and get goosebumps. Yeah. I mean, there's just, how do you pick? Because we mentioned Seattle.
And that's the thing. Every song is
La Vie Bohème.
Like, everyone knows pretty much every song. And, like, audiences, they applaud before songs even start because they know what's coming. And
Which
they just get
excited. Which
is
very daunting sometimes because you know they're kind of always one step ahead of you.
Right. They know what's coming.
They
next.
Know what's coming. Yeah. And they expect it to be done a certain way. And we never in the cast feel that we have to kind of play into people's expectations, because I think that's the benefit of having a new cast. The benefit of seeing live theater is as much as you expect it to be a certain way, our hope is that maybe you see something that you've never seen before, you've never heard before, or you hear a line a certain way and you go, oh my God, I never knew what that line meant, and now it makes sense.
Yeah.
And people have asked, they've said, how is this different than the production that we saw in 1996? And what I say to that is usually, it's the same production, but we are a new generation of actors and artists, and we interpret it differently. And I think we are that perfect gateway of the old Renheads to now the new Renheads. And I mean, of course, we're never going to know what life was like back then, but it's coming to it with a modern day sensibility, and seeing how and what it means to us now.
And the other thing that's so interesting is this show, this production, is for the fans, and it's brought to you by the fans, because every single one of us on stage has been a fan of this show since before we can remember.
And
so,
every one of us in this room right now.
Exactly. And everyone who comes to see the show is taking part in that. And it's a very almost religious experience, because we're all appreciating this work. And it's never really about us on stage and you in the audience. No. And there's a disconnect. It's like, let's
go on,
appreciate
this
story for what it is, and we hope to do it justice every night, and we hope that you will
come and celebrate and share into it. And
absolutely, man, I'm just getting goosebumps thinking about that shared experience you're talking about. It's going to be great. And like we said at the top, this is the last stop on the tour, on this 20th
last
anniversary
tour.
So come take part in history. Really, it's your last chance to see it here in this anniversary tour. Again, guys, it's now through Sunday at the National Theater. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm so excited to see this tonight. But thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate
it. Thank you.